It's The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and it's great to have you with us. There are a lot of different voices in the national conversation about policing in the United States and how to make it better. Recently, The Takeaway convened five people in law enforcement, advocacy, and academia, and asked them to come together to talk about the way forward. In an hour-long forum hosted on Facebook, we tackled what's broken in today's system and what it would take to fix it, and we answered questions from the thousands who tuned in. Today, we're bringing you excerpts of that conversation. In this first section, you'll hear from Houston Police Chief Art Acevedo, retired NYPD Detective Mark Claxton, and Janae Nelson, Associate Director Counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. And Janae told me that she wants the public to know just how much money we invest in police departments and law enforcement agencies and why that matters.
It is a representation of our values. It is a representation of societal investments. And what we're doing to the tune of $270 million a year, back if you look at 2018, is investing federal funds in enforcement agencies. That's just federal funding. It doesn't even speak to the local and state funding that we invest in local law enforcement. And what that does is divest money from education, social services, from all sorts of supports that could in fact ensure that crime is decreased, that could in fact ensure that our society has a better social safety net, that can bring about the public safety and service and care that all residents of this country deserve. Instead, we are expanding not only through actual dollars, but through the redeployment of military equipment and in-kind donation to over 18,000 law enforcement agencies across the country. So we're funding them in multiple ways. And in the New York City circumstance, the budget last year was $6 billion, and there's been $1 billion removed from the upcoming budget. But no one knows exactly where those funds will be reinvested. Will they be reinvested in agencies that we can be certain will make a difference in communities? It is an important first step. It is an important symbolic act, but much more needs to be done to examine the outsized role of law enforcement in communities across the country.
Mark, at the top of this forum, you mentioned the different types of issues that we're seeing in police departments, and one of them was militarization of the actual the police themselves. And I can say that I covered the aftermath of the killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, for the New York Times, and witnessed for my very self the tanks that were coming down the street. The tear gas and all of these other things that I think many people never imagined they would see. How do you pull back on militarization of the police? I mean, where do you even begin to pull back on that so we can move forward?
Well, I think it's important for people to keep in mind that actual Defense Department program was implemented in 97 under the Clinton administration, and really initially the military equipment was supposed to be used in the ongoing effort to eradicate drugs in our community. So if you can imagine, that didn't go too well. The expansion of that program since that time has created a scenario where you have police departments that have now deep reliance on the use of the military equipment in the civilian space, which is totally inappropriate and increases the level of danger. How you go about changing that is that you restrict the allocation of those equipment items and you make demands that these police agencies identify specifically what the need is and what the use of these equipment items will be. But I think more importantly, what you have to do is to defund the ability of agencies to bring into a civilian space this heavy-duty military equipment, you know, these things that are just not necessary in the scope. And what you do when you put military equipment on the street in the police capacity is that you make a clear delineation. It's us against them. It's the us against the enemy. And the community picks up on that, responds and reacts to that, and feels as if they are being invaded, when in fact what policing should be about is protecting and serving. So just the use of the military equipment is very problematic and should be eradicated moving forward.
Chief Acevedo, you have been very vocal about the need for police reform, but I'm wondering, you said that you've gotten rid of a couple of bushels of bad apples, not just the occasional quote-unquote bad apple, but what are the conversations that you're having in this moment with the officers that work under you, who are probably watching this moment and interpreting it in many different ways? There are some folks who are saying the police are under siege. How are you communicating this need for change to your officers?
Well, first of all, I let them know that history is watching. They're watching everything that we're doing, and that this is our moment in time in history, this generation of police officer, to move the ball forward. And how we respond today will define our generation of cops and police leadership for generations to come. And so I tell them that adversity actually is taken as an opportunity to engage in lifting up good policing by doing everything we can to get rid of the bad bushes of police officers. And I can tell you that, at least for my city and in this department, the vast majority of our people support it. As a matter of fact, I've been here for only 3.5 years. I've unfortunately had to run off quite a few people, and it touches my heart when I have officers who will come up to me from a shift that's worth two 28-year veterans that have been, quite frankly, thorns in the side of everybody for a long time, get run out. This generation of cop, a lot of them are actually coming forward and say, thank you. Thank you for finally doing something about it. So we don't want our officers to run away from this. We want our officers to recognize the history of policing is ugly. There's still a lot of ugliness in policing, and they truly are part of the solution. But I got to push back a little bit on the demilitarization piece, because it's not about the equipment. It's about the proper use of the equipment, the circumstances, the policy in the use of the equipment, and the proper supervision, command, and control. For example, Dayton, Ohio, when we had a suspect murdered 9 people, an active shooter, last year. He was about to go into a nightclub or a bar crowded with people with a 100-round drum and an assault rifle. And I was a police officer with a patrol rifle that was able to stop that man from killing people. Or the MRAPs that people think are tanks. We have used those during hurricanes to rescue people. So again, we've got to be real careful that we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater and that we don't paint with broad brushes. It's truly about leadership. It's about accountability. It's about proper training, proper policy, and proper oversight from the communities that we serve.
Would anyone want to respond to that about the militarization, the fact that it could be? Go ahead, Mark.
Well, it's just I think what tends to happen is it's sort of like giving a kid sugar. Once you give them the sugar, they become addicted to the sugar. They believe that they cannot exist without the sugar. And I think in law enforcement, because they've been exposed and allowed to utilize this equipment, now it's become vitally important. And I have a question, because I mean, I have some years of experience in the police department. I wonder how we did it before there was military and defense equipment that was allocated to the police departments. I wonder how we did it before there was a tank rolling through the street. I think we have to really kind of weigh and say, listen, is it more useful or more detrimental to our development and establishing and cultivating relationships in the community to have tanks marching, rolling down the street? Now, you can call it's MRAP, I understand that, but is it useful? Is it something that we can do without? Or has it gotten to the point where now we're over-relying on this military equipment? And I think it's the latter. I think we're over-relying on it and not recognizing what that symbolizes and means to a community. It means we're under siege, we are the enemy, and we are being not served and protected here.
Janae, did you want to weigh in?
Yeah, I also wanted to add that we have to think about whose hands we're putting this military equipment in. And when we think back to the fact that the FBI identified back in 2006 that police departments are being infiltrated by white nationalist organizations, we must rethink how we are empowering police forces without the appropriate screening, without the appropriate training. And we also know that to suggest that military equipment is only used, and I'm not suggesting that Police Chief Acevedo said this, but others may think that we only use military equipment in the most dire circumstances where we're preventing mass shootings or we're preventing the loss of mass civilian life. And that's simply not the case. We are seeing military equipment deployed against protesters who are exercising their constitutional right to peaceful assembly and free speech. And they are met with officers in riot gear, in tanks, and using ballistic style missiles. That just can't be the way this country operates, particularly when you add the overlay of the type of officers that are being let into police departments without sufficient screening and without sufficient oversight and accountability. So we can't isolate one piece of this and suggest that that piece is a safety mechanism for American society at large if we don't examine many of the corrosive features that exist within law enforcement agencies. And to give military equipment to officers and law enforcement agencies that have such massive structural problems is an extraordinarily dangerous thing, not only to individuals and communities, but also to our democracy at large.
We've talked about militarization and the use of that technology, but there are other technologies that police departments around the country, and some of us have alluded to that in this forum, are implementing and have been implementing for the past couple of years. There was a big push for this, particularly under the Obama administration, to increase the use of data collection and technology within police departments. I'm specifically referring to things like SpotShotter, which allows police departments to isolate where and when gunshots are heard. Body cameras, which we're all very familiar with at this point, predictive policing, which is the use of data to predict behavior. Some of these were supposed to be an answer to police accountability. Rashad, how are they working out?
Well, they're not working out. There are reforms around the edges that don't actually deal with the structural sort of challenges that we have. And a structural challenge is that video alone does not lead to accountability if we don't have the mechanisms to actually create accountability. And while the movement has, I think, exacted some accountability when a video has appeared, it shouldn't take people taking to the streets to protest to get someone who shoots or puts their knee on someone on camera and to get arrested, to be charged. And that's exactly where we're sort of at, you know, in all of this. And so I think time and time again, I absolutely understand and appreciate the sort of energy and focus at wanting to figure out a way to make this work, at wanting to figure out if we can just add body cameras, we can like reduce crime, we can reduce police misconduct by this percentage point. If we just ban chokeholds, we can like make things better. If police are right now not engaged in our communities and in a project of safety, but a project of control, then what ends up happening is that control becomes the bottom line. And that is what we are experiencing time and time again. And I know this is sometimes hard for people to want to see because our media tells us a story about policing, our culture tells us a story about safety and policing, and we want to believe that we can just fix this and make this work. We could just add new technologies on problematic systems and make it work, but that doesn't work in any industry. If the banks are not working and if the banks are exploiting and targeting Black people, giving them new technology will make them just target and exploit us in new and creative ways. And so I am not against new technology at all as a person who like leverages technology to supercharge social change. What I believe is that you can't just overlay technology if you don't change the structures and the systems at the heart of the problem. And that means that we have to fundamentally downsize policing in this country, and we have to put our money and resources and things that actually ensure that our communities are safe.
Phil, can you help us connect the dots between the behavior changes you say we need, the technology that's being implemented and has been implemented, and how do we use those two things to move forward and create the reform that we're talking about today?
Okay, so I think it's really important. A lot of things that Rashad has been saying are just dead on. I want to amplify them. There's one element of this, which is in many cities across the country, there was no such thing as formal law enforcement until there was property that had two legs and could learn to read and write. Mm-hmm. Right? And then after that, there were formally racist laws, and it was law enforcement's job to enforce formal racism. And at no point in this country's history did we say, hey, that stuff that we did that was super racist and the group of people that we gave that job to, we should do something entirely different. There has not been a full accounting for the previous mission of law enforcement and the evolution to the present. Now, that doesn't mean that current law enforcement are just slave catchers, right? I hear that. I see that. That's not at all what I'm saying. But there needs to be a break between the past mission and the current mission. That needs to be formalized so we can be clear. The mission should be public safety. That's one part of the project. We need to really, literally reimagine, well, what are the levers that we give so that folks don't have to call police in the first place? right? What are the set of options that we give to communities so that they have resources to handle it themselves, or so that they can call someone to deal with substance abuse who doesn't come in with a badge and a gun? And at the same time, we need to be engaged in changing whoever is given that job, right, and whatever the mission is, so that what they're doing isn't harmful. And I just have to push back on the idea that under the Obama administration, there was a move towards using data, and that was towards predictive policing, right? Like, that's just, there are a whole bunch of different things that were listed there that are different elements of what different folks have been trying to do. Predictive policing is not part of the pro-equity movements inside of law enforcement. Predictive policing is an attempt to get more accurate at who's committing the crimes, but because of the way that artificial intelligence works, which is artificial intelligence is just human intelligence supercharged, the biases are often baked in, and the attempts to try and remove those biases have not involved communities, right? So there's that. Body cameras have never seen a moment when the struggle for Black liberation has been aided by more state surveillance, right? So it's not the case that all of these things go together, and also on top of that, these things were never funded at a level that allowed for scale. They were never funded so Janae talked about the $270 million federal government puts in. That's on top of $115 billion that get put in at the state and local level. And at best, police reforms inside of law enforcement are funded at $10, $15 million a year. That's not going to get the kind of change that we're talking about. So what I'm hoping we're going to leave the takeaway, if you will, from today is at the same time that we're interrogating the mission of law enforcement and how to right size on public safety while we're giving the resources to Black communities that have been defunded for generations, we also have to do the yes and of actually scaling the things we know work inside of law enforcement to make them less deadly, to make them less racist. And that's not just
what are some of those things, Phil?
That's exactly. So that's the actual cultural elements of this. So, right, Chief Acevedo said that culture eats policy for breakfast. He's absolutely right. The reason why folks have been focusing on data is because law enforcement is a data-driven industry. Law enforcement goes out at the behest of CompStat all the time. Where's the crime? That's where we're supposed to go. But we've been measuring crime in law enforcement for the last quarter century, and we haven't been measuring justice. Right. If we did that, then you could say, you know what, over there, stop beating people up over there. Right. Stop hassling the folks who are on the corners and talk to the people who know where violence is actually occurring. If we measured the things that actually mattered, we could make law enforcement more aligned with community values at the same time that we're trying to adjust the mission or radically change the mission to align with community values. It's got to be in everything. Situation now. It can't be this or that, and that false dichotomy is absolutely going to end up undermining the moment that we've got and end up with a huge backlash 5 years from now. Remember that the rise in mass incarceration came precisely at the moment when the entirety of American culture was saying, you know what, we think we've gotten this wrong. We think we've gotten inclusion wrong. It was the backlash to that that led to the largest incarceration of humanity in human history. So I just want to make sure that we're thinking long haul on this and we're not just thinking short term.
That was an excerpt of a recent takeaway forum on the future of policing with psychologist Dr. Philip Atiba Goff, who you just heard there, along with Rashad Robinson, president of Color of Change, Houston Police Chief Art Acevedo, retired NYPD Detective Mark Claxton, and Janae Nelson, Associate Director Counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. And there's lots more to this conversation, and you can find that in its entirety at thetakeaway.org. And lots more on police reform for us to talk about on the show. Tell us what you want to hear when it comes to the future of policing in America. We're at 877-8MYTAKE.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.